Number 15, petition to Noah, while there still is a Noah, to establish a whale protect. That's not even funny. I mean, that's just sad. To establish a whale protection zone for southern resident killer whales. This is a briefing. So, Hannah, your name's first.
Yeah. I'll just be the introduction.
I'm not going to name Mike first. I knew that.
I'm Hannah Anderson, listing and recovery in the wildlife program, and I'm pleased to be here with my colleagues from enforcement program, as well as Lynn Berry from NOAA. And Lynn's going to do all the heavy lifting here today, so she'll be presenting today about the petition they received for a whale protection zone.
Hi, thank you for the invitation to come. I see some new faces since last I was here talking about our southern resident killer whales that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. So perhaps I'll give you just a quick overview. They've been listed under the ESA as endangered since 2005. That was following kind of a 20% population decline. And since then, they've been hovering somewhere around 80 whales for about the last decade or so. The main threats identified at the time of listing were, do they have enough of the Chinook salmon prey that they prefer and depend on? They live a long time and have high levels of pollutants and contaminants, and there is disturbance from vessels and sound. So that's the threat I'm going to focus on today.
Just a quick question. You said live a long time. What is the lifespan? I guess I've never asked that.
Yeah, so the males live to 50 or 60. Some of the females we think are over 80, maybe even 90 years old. Oh. And through that long lifespan, they can accumulate high levels of toxins. Yep. So just to give you a little bit of a background, I mentioned the listing. We also have a recovery plan that was put in place in 2008. And even before that was finalized, we knew vessels were an issue and can affect the whale's behavior. These are also acoustic animals that use sound to find food and to also communicate with each other. They're very social. So in 2007, we started a regulatory process with an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, just asking for public comments about whether vessel regulations were needed, what type might be appropriate to protect these endangered whales. In 2009, based on the comments we got and the basic science that was available to us, we put out a proposed rule and had a request for public comments. We also held public meetings. And then in 2011, we put out a final rule, and I'll give you the details of what's in there. And since that final rule, we've been implementing and also following up on the conversation about protections for whales, including a whale protection workshop that we had where we sort of checked in on where we were with the vessel regulations we put into place and to see what else might be needed. As part of the rulemaking process, we did an environmental assessment under NEPA. And this looked at a variety of alternatives. We looked at benefits and impacts to different resources, including the whales, but also the whale watch industry and recreation and shipping and safety and a number of other resources. And that was a great summary of all the scientific information at the time about vessel impacts. And we also had some data on potential economic impacts for the different alternatives. And our conclusion was that the regulations we put in place would result in a benefit to the whales and would have no significant impact to industry or recreation. So these are the protective regulations we put into place in 2011. We have an approach restriction, 200 yards, and we also have a prohibition on vessels being parked in the path of the whales out to 400 yards. And this applies to all types of vessels, although there are some exemptions for fishermen that are actively tending or retrieving their gear, for safety, for ships in the shipping lane, and for enforcement and research that's permitted. Those are some of the exceptions. To implement those new regulations, we had a strong education and outreach program and are continuing to work with partners. There are some vessel education and monitoring groups out of the Whale Museum called Soundwatch, and on the Canadian side of the border called Strait Watch. We work with WDFW, with DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada, and the Pacific Whale Watch Association to make sure everyone has the right information about what the rules are. And in addition to those two regulations, we also have a variety of other guidelines that are in place to help boaters responsibly view the whales. And we've updated those over the years once the regulations were in place and then also as new information is available to us. We have a joint enforcement agreement with WDFW, and they've had an Endangered Species Act grant for the last several years to help enforce the regulations. We've also continued to monitor what's going on out there with the boats and the whales, primarily working with Soundwatch, collecting data on vessel activity around the whales and compliance with the rules, and also trying to gauge some data on economics to see if our conclusions in our NEPA analysis were correct. So this is what we're talking about today. And in 2009, NOAA had actually proposed a no-go zone along the west side of San Juan Island as part of the proposed rules. But in 2011, we did not include that zone as part of our final rule. And some of the reasons were that we got a great deal of public opposition. And we know that for something like that to be effective, we have to have a certain level of understanding and buy-in from the community. And we also had a number of alternatives that were suggested in our rulemaking process that we hadn't fully analyzed. And we got comments that our economic analysis was not quite adequate to describe some of the economic impacts, particularly from something like this no-go zone. And we didn't include it in the final rule, but we did say that we would consider the concept in the future because we know that it would have benefits for the whales. And now, in November of 2016, we received a petition from three nonprofit groups asking NOAA to restart a regulatory rulemaking process to create a whale protection zone to support recovery of the endangered southern residents. So our first step in looking at that petition, it's under the Administrative Procedure Act, was to put it out for public comment. And so we put that out for comment in January, and the comment period is open through April 11th. And we requested quite a bit of different types of information to help us decide whether we would move forward with a regulatory process to consider a whale protection zone or not. So that's where we are now. We're in the process of gathering public comment to make that decision. And some of the things we asked for comment on are there alternative options? What scientific or commercial information is out there to help us evaluate anything we pursue and any relevant information. And I also wanted to mention that in addition to the public comments, we'll also have one more document to help us make a decision. And that's a review that we've undertaken of the current vessel regulations. So we're looking at how have boats complied with the rules. We've got a review of compliance. We're looking at the biological impacts. Have we seen an improvement for the whales? Have we reduced sound or disturbance from boats? And looking at enforcement, what's been our experience with NOAA and WDFW enforcement on the water? Our education program to raise awareness, particularly with the recreational boaters that might not be aware of the rules. And then also gathering some economic information on tourism in the general area to see if there have been any changes since our rules went into place. And that's what I wanted to share with you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions along with my colleagues.
What's the bottom slide?
Oh, sorry. I can describe it. So this is our Northwest Fisheries Science Center research team putting a D-tag. This is a digital acoustic tag onto the whale with a suction cup. And we're able to record the sounds that the whales are hearing. And while that tag is on the whales, we're also collecting information about all the boats that are around that whale. How fast are they going? How far away are they? And this is all helping inform us about how vessels can impact the whales. And so that some of that analysis of the DTAG data has been done, but there's more coming to help us really understand how vessels might affect the foraging behavior of the whales, which is one of our big concerns. Yeah.
How wide is the no-go zone?
Let's see.
I can't read it in the tiny little print here.
So I believe it's a mile from shore is the full zone. It has several different aspects. It has a kind of a no-boat zone, but also a buffer, which would be a no-wake zone.
And a follow-up might be, is that okay? I think we're talking mostly here about your just normal recreational boaters and possibly whale watch boats. But you said that there was an exemption which would maintain for commercial fishermen who were tending their gear and emergencies and some other exemptions. As somebody who has, I've actually and enjoyed this. I've been out in the water in a kayak and had enforcement come up, not to chastise me, but just to tell me what the rules were. It was pretty good. But so what we're talking about here in this mile offshore, can you elaborate just a little bit on how that would affect the commercial fishers?
So at this point, we have not done any analysis on this new proposal.
Okay.
We've just put it out to receive public comments. If we were to move forward with a rulemaking, we would propose something and have public comments on that, and we would do a full analysis as we have in the past. So I can speak a little bit to what we found in the past analysis. When we proposed a smaller, it was a skinnier and shorter zone than what's in this petition. The impacts we looked at for fishing communities were displacement from fishing in that exact 6 square mile area that we proposed. So we didn't feel that there would be a reduction in the opportunity or the amount of fish that could be caught. It would just occur in different places. So those are that's an example of an effect that we analyzed in the past.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming, and I guess my question is more kind of process. So you have this proposal from the NGOs, this 1 mile. So if NOAA were to say, yeah, okay, let's start this process again, you wouldn't necessarily have to put out or develop how should I say this? You wouldn't be locked into the proposal that the NGOs have provided. You could modify it, right? I mean, is that...
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. So we would adapt it if we decided to go forward with a rulemaking with, you know, additional considerations than what might be in this petition, and through that NEPA analysis, assessing kind of costs and benefits to different resources.
Okay. And one other kind of maybe not directly on... topic question, but whale related. I recall that there was some concern or controversy with a death of a whale that was found to be attributed to the tagging operation. Maybe not this, but where are we on that? Has the tagging effort resumed, or is NOAA still evaluating, you know, kind of its efforts in monitoring the whales?
Yeah, so that was a stranding of L95, an adult male from L-Pod, who had a satellite tag, which is different than the suction yes. cup tagging, embedded in the fin. And that whale washed up dead on Canadian waters, and they've done a full necropsy and examination. We invited a kind of a special panel of veterinary pathologists to review those findings. And it's a potential... outcome that the tag site was a pathway for a fungal infection that resulted in the death of the whale. There are some uncertainties there, and our permit group is reviewing the situation to see if there's a way to mitigate the risks that we learned about through that whale. And at this point, our satellite tag program is still suspended pending
okay.
additional investigation.
Just a far-off question, but you mentioned dead whale and Canada. Mm-hmm. And it's got nothing to do with poutine. So, but the outflow of direct sewage from Victoria, has there ever been any studies of that impact on the whale's health?
As far as the contaminants we're most concerned about for these long-lived mammals, they're more the persistent organic pollutants, things like PCBs and DDT and the newer emerging contaminants like the flame retardants, the PBDEs. Those are some of the contaminants we're most concerned about for killer whales. So things that are in sewage, it could include some of those contaminants, but I think what people are most concerned about are the fecal coliforms and other products of wastewater that probably aren't as big an issue for the whales themselves.
On the persistence, have they done point source identification?
Yes, there
other
are some
than atmospheric deposition.
Yeah, there's atmospheric deposition. There are some legacy sites for the older contaminants we don't use anymore, like PCBs and DDT. And one that we focused on in our recovery program is the flame retardants, the PBDEs, because they are still in use, although they are being phased out somewhat on the West Coast. And we actually looked at Joint Base Lewis-McChord's wastewater outfall system, and they've upgraded their treatment, and that was helpful in assessing the impacts to the whales. And we've been working with Department of Ecology and also the Puget Sound Partnership to identify additional monitoring that could be done to help us better understand the levels of these legacy contaminants going into the system and how they might affect the whales.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair. Probably hate seeing me again, don't you, Lynn?
No, it's nice to see you, Larry.
Just a little bit of background. I don't know if you did, and if you did, I didn't hear it. That's San Juan Island. Mm-hmm. And that's the west side of San Juan Island. That's called Harold Straits. And that area there, I probably have more man hours out in that stretch of shoreline than anybody alive. Thousands of days, I'm sure, fishing and commercial in the past and recreational for a long time. And I can't begin to tell you how many times I've seen the whales, had them up next to my boat, roll up and look at my kids. You know, I mean, they're out there for the same reasons we're out there. There's reasons to be out there. Things happen out there. And hundreds of times, not to exaggerate, I've been out there when there's commercial fisheries open. And those commercial fisheries are quite robust. I mean, that's a very, very important area for the commercial fisheries to take place. And also in the summer months, it is probably, in my mind, it's the most popular place for the recreational fishermen to fish. And the recreational fishermen, when they're out there fishing, 90%+ of them are trolling, which means they're moving along at somewhere between 1 and 2 miles per hour. And when they're trolling along with their 10-horse outboard on the back, four strokes, not making any noise, they're busy watching their rods over the stern of the boat, see if they might get lucky enough to get a fish, and all of a sudden the whales will show up. If they're coming north to south and your bows point north, you won't see them until they go by you, blow on you, then they'll go by. And if you're fishing along, many times you won't see them. They'll come right up behind you, and they'll go under your gear. You can see them in the water. They don't touch your fishing line, and they just head off and do what whales do. It's no harm, no foul. So I really take exception to this petition. You can pick a problem. You can talk about pollution. You can talk about food source. You can talk about noise. But I can tell you categorically, I used to keep a boat at Snug Harbor, Lynn. So I had a pretty good perspective for 20 years I did, on what goes on out there. There may be an issue that's affecting the whales. I'm not questioning that, but it isn't the boating that's the issue. That's my view on that for now.
I guess just to add to Bob's, I'm a little confused on the process because now this is a notice of receipt of petition request for public comment. Now, is this a third-party lawsuit brewing, or where are we at? And who's going to be the final arbiter that something needs to be done?
I can't speak to whether someone is going to file a lawsuit on this topic.
But three NGOs submitted. Mm-hmm. What they do? They submitted and want you to gather comments?
They've submitted a petition to NOAA asking right. That we go through a federal rulemaking process to establish a whale protection zone. So that would include...
So let's play this out.
A proposal and a public comment and a final rule. That's what it asked us.
Let's play this out. So if you decide we're not going to establish this, do you think then they'll file a lawsuit or what?
I don't know. The three NGOs that have petitioned us are Center for Biological Diversity, Orca Relief, and Project Seawolf. if you're familiar with any of those.
Well, I know, but I'm just trying to see where they're trying to take you, steer you down the road, because needless to say, they have an end that they want to see. And whether they're just doing the process now and hoping you'll step up and do, I don't know. That's why I'm posing the question to you, because there's got to be an end to this, or they wouldn't have done this.
They're seeking additional protection for this endangered population of whales.
Okay, so they're seeking protection.
Yes.
So are you saying that if we don't do this, then they're going to file a lawsuit?
I have no idea, honestly.
That's where I'm at, because there again, I guess it's just like why we buy insurance. Do we do it because, you know, we risk the benefits and the everything else? So that's why I would like to, you know, that's why I'm posing this question to you, to see where in the world we're headed with this.
I really can't say at this time. If someone
nobody wants to speculate, do they? Yeah.
Certainly not to in any way answer your question or take Mr. Freymeyer's job away from him. But what is important in potential litigation, I believe, as somebody who used to regularly sue the state, is that we go through this Administrative Procedures Act properly. And if we do that, and I think that's part of what the presentation here is, if we do our part correctly, then if we get sued, it'll be on different grounds than that Fish and Wildlife didn't do what we're supposed to do under the law.
We'll talk about this later, because there again, you're gathering comments. If it all comes back negative, then you're not going to do anything. So I'm just trying to play it out, war game it down the road, and see where they're headed with this.
I certainly don't have an answer to that question on what the petitioners are doing, but in the petition itself, it is provides a lot of flexibility for and options for how, and asks questions. It suggests this no-go zone, but also opens the door for NOAA to suggest other alternatives.
Is that a regional petition, or is that wherever orca populations are found within the U.S.?
Specific to the southern resident killer whales.
And it's specific to that shoreline.
Specific to that shoreline. Yeah. That's what they're suggesting specifically.
Okay.
Do you want to mention bring their attention to
any other?
Interesting.
They did. Deputy Chiefs, just reminding you all that we did. The agency did get together, so Fish and Enforcement and Wildlife, and talked about what our comments may be to the, so there is a draft letter in your book, and I assume you've all seen.
All right. Is there more?
That's basically it. Well, if you have other questions, we're happy to sit here as long as you want.
Michael's got the mic.
Yeah. Thank you, Deputy Chief.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to, I guess, sort of summarize. So NOAA's laid out what their intentions are, which we appreciate Lynn being here and being transparent about where they are in terms of, you know, process and going forward. And then the agency provided our thoughts on options that may better protect whales, but also consider, you know, a lot of the things that have been considered in the past as we go down this road, and a copy of that letter is in your briefing book. So this is an opportunity for people to share their views. We've shared our views. I think we're going to continue to have discussions with NOAA on a formal basis, and that's really all there is at this point, unless, of course, the commissioners or the director have some other solutions or ideas that we want the agency to bring forward as we move through the process, and either add more regulatory layers or not. I mean, nothing's been concluded, only a commitment to evaluate the situation, right?
Before I turn over, Bob, just a follow-up on my question. Is this precedent-setting by these groups in terms of a specific area on whales? I mean, Again, I'm just thinking whale orcas are around a lot of different places around the U.S. Has this been, that tactic been utilized in the past? Do you know? I don't know.
Resident killer whales. Southern residents are the only killer whale population that is listed under the Endangered Species Act. Northern residents are also listed in Canada under their Species at Risk Act, but in the U.S., under the ESA, southern residents are the only listed.
But this region is not just Puget Sound. I mean, not just this area. I mean, you go down the Oregon coast and find them, right?
Oh, the southern residents range from about Monterey, California, up to southeast Alaska.
So I guess the question is, has there been any precedent of taking an area from Monterey up here and doing what this petition is doing?
No, this is a new approach.
That's okay.
And honestly, I haven't dealt with a petition under the Administrative Procedure Act before.
Okay.
So to date, it's been petitions under the Endangered Species Act for the listing. We also do, I'll mention, we have another petition that we're considering, which was asking NOAA to revise the critical habitat designation, which currently is in inland waters of Washington. And we got a petition asking us to expand that to include areas along the Pacific coast. And that's currently under consideration.
Okay, thank you. Bob?
Yeah. Thanks. As to the letter, that was distributed to the commission, I think, last week. And I thank the department. I know there was a lot of input on different from different branches of the department. And I think the letter is this is just me personally. I think it's a good letter. I think it brings out some very good points, and I'm sure NOAA will consider it and give it the proper consideration that it deserves. And just so my other commissioners, and it kind of build on what Larry mentioned, is that for the Fraser River sockeye fishery, which takes place in this area, it's incorrect to assume that, well, if we just close off this little very small sliver, that it would not have an impact on the fishery. It would have a profound impact on the fishery because this is a migratory path that the Fraser River sockeye take, either Harrow or Rosario Strait, and they're not their migration takes them very close to the beach. That's where you access the fish. You can't. That's where they school up. That's where they're accessible, and this fishery has been going on for many, many years. So that's the concern, is that you know, that you if the assumption is that, well, yeah, we can just move somewhere else. It's an incorrect assumption. And I know we brought that out, tried to very clearly in the first go-around. And I thank NOAA for their consideration and backing off. There were some really heated meetings and both on both sides of the issue. So enough talking. Thanks.
If I could add to what Bob said, that corridor there is not only where the Fraser sockeye migrate, but Fraser pinks in big numbers, Fraser chinook, which we've had a discussion about that being their favorite morsels to chew on. So it's a real important area. But I want to ask you another question that I know it's NOAA, but I'm sure it's not in your wheelhouse, but Lynn, but your agency that you work for also, correct me if I'm wrong, is in charge of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And I think it's fair to say that whoever your colleagues are that handle that, they might want to look into the Marine Mammal Protection Act as it relates to predation on salmon stocks throughout the Salish Sea, including Fraser Chinook and all the other species, because those populations are growing at an exponential rate, and the food sources that whales and people enjoy are being eliminated from the food chain by seals and sea lions. So not trying to change the subject, but I think it's worthy of putting on the record that it needs to be addressed sooner than later.
And it is on topic. This is one of the things in the past we've really focused on this connection between southern resident killer whales and Chinook salmon. But we know that the food web is much broader than that and includes a number of other salmon predators, including us, including the pinniped populations that are very abundant in our waters. So we've worked with some funding from the Pacific Salmon Commission. Our Northwest Fisheries Science Center is working on sort of that food web modeling that gives that broader view of who are the Chinook consumers and how would changes in abundance of Chinook affect different species.
That's good
a great
news.
Point.
Thank
yeah.
you. Thanks, team. Team Orca.
Kyle,
and
do you want to say something?
We look forward to your comments. Thank you.
Most of my comments, Commissioner Carpenter, were covered by you and Commissioner Kehoe, the importance of that area to those fisheries and making sure that's considered in any rulemaking.
Thanks for coming.